Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 9th, 2014, and welcome to episode 87 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
Will I ever... The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and any other retro topics we managed to stumble into. So today with us, as always, is Earl Evans out in Portland. How are you, Earl?
Hey, doing good, Paul. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I forgot to mention my name, but my name is Paul Hagstrom.
Yeah, let me introduce you. Live from Boston, Massachusetts, it's Paul Hagstrom.
Hooray. I have had not much sleep recently. That's okay. And down on the other side of the world is Michael Mulhern. How are you?
I'm great. I lie. I've been wrestling palm trees, and I almost lost.
And joining us today for the first time is Jack Nutting, who is in Sweden. How are you, Jack?
Hi, Paul. I'm good, thanks. Today was actually Father's Day in Sweden, so I'm sitting here wearing, of course, my new socks and ties that my children gave me. No, not really, but it actually is Father's Day, but they didn't give me socks and ties.
What else to say? So Jack is here at least in part as an Atari expert to make up a hole that we have dug ourselves into. So actually, maybe that's a good place to start since you're new here, Jack. What give us some background on your computing history?
Sure. Well, I started out. I guess the first computer I programmed on was an Apple II in about 1982 in fifth grade or something like that. I can remember the school district had one that we got to sort of share. And that kind of got me going. And then I think about a half year later or so, I managed to scrounge up enough money to buy an Atari 400 and kind of followed that path for a while. Later on, graduated up to an Atari ST and then an Amiga. And then I was a grown up. And then I started programming, doing real work, and kind of left behind all this retro stuff for a long, long time until the past couple of years when I started poking around with things again.
Excellent. Yeah, one of the things that hit my radar is this talk you gave, talking about the creation of, I guess, what do you call it, Flippy Bit, on the a new Flappy Bird clone on the Atari 2600. It's definitely. We'll have a link to this. It's very, very easily digested and interesting, and actually quite content dense, I think.
Yeah, so this is something that I'm primarily an iOS developer these days, and I've done a lot of different things on my own. I made a few games, and last wintertime, when there was this sort of Flappy Bird mania, I decided to make my own Flappy Bird clone called Flippy Bit, which was styled, looked like an old Atari game. I even had like the genuine colors from the Atari palette and that sort of thing. And then I'd also been playing around with doing some programming for the 2600 using emulation and things, and it dawned on me, hey, I bet I could make this game for that as well. And so I sort of did. It's not quite done, but it's working, and it's kind of fun in the sense that as much as any Flappy Bird game can be fun, it's kind of fun, I guess, but more fun to make than to play. That's my motto.
Amazing, the stuff going on in the 2600, though. In the last episode of Antic, they were talking about some ports that had been done, I think, from 2600 to the 800 series, and not ports that were done back in the day, but ports that had been done recently. So,
right. There's a surprising amount of interest in this, and like this sort of homebrew scene for both the Atari 2600 and for the Atari 8-bits. There's a lot of stuff going on in various parts of the world. So it's been interesting to sort of go into this and also see how, like, along with this, that there's been this upsurge in Atari 8-bit specific podcasts in the past year or so. Suddenly there are three.
Yeah.
which is pretty wild.
I've definitely found it interesting because I really did not know very much about the Atari before, but it's sort of like this propaganda effect. You know, I'm starting. I hear about it all the time. It must be interesting.
Yep, we'll get you one day.
Yep. Okay, so we are now on episode 87, and for the last few episodes, we have been devoting the episode to the year of the 1980s that corresponds to it. So we're going to talk about milestones of 1987. So I'll list a couple of things here, and then we can maybe jump back to talk about them to whatever extent we want to. But so computers that we have in our list here are IBM introduced the PS2, which I guess introduced the VGA standard as well, which has lasted forever. Acorn Archimedes was the first RISC home computer. Apple IIe had the Platinum Edition out. The Amiga 500 in 2000 came out. Apple Macintosh 2, now expandable and in color, as well as the Macintosh SE, not expandable, but an improvement over the line. And the last one in this list that we have is the Canon Cat, which has an interesting history of its own. So anyone want to jump in on any of those?
Well, the IBM PS2 was the first IBM PC that I used. I actually quite liked them. They were a good, solid work machine. And down in the software section, when we get down to there, I believe this was also the year that Windows 2 was released. But, I was using that as a scanning workstation for document work on mainframes, using PCs to generate the resources, load them up to the mainframe for printing. So blending my two worlds together.
Quick couple comments on the PS2. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was working at Hughes Aircraft, large aerospace company in Southern California. So IBM, as part of their marketing blitz, came in and did a PS2 day at our company. We got a big conference room and people came in and took a look at the machines. I remember the first time that I saw VGA graphics, I was actually stunned that some of those images were coming out of an IBM compatible. It was beautiful, honestly. And then they took us through the process of disassembling and reassembling one of the PS2 computers, and you could do it with basically no tools. And the things snapped apart and snapped together wonderfully for repair purposes. So all in all, we were pretty impressed. It's just the industry, I guess, wasn't impressed with the microchannel architecture and switching to a new proprietary thing. So unfortunately, that didn't go over. But I will say the first time we saw the PS2s, we were pretty wowed.
Yeah, I really like it when the machines can be taken apart like that. The Lisa turns out to be like that. You know, another one that not many people actually had the opportunity to take apart, but little knobs unscrew and you pull things out, and it's there's really almost no tools required.
Yeah, that's what I found with the PS2. That it was a very friendly machine as far as getting the hardware. Because at that stage, we had the 3270 cards. There was the SCSI card and scanner cards and everything. So dropping them in, customizing machines. The only thing I didn't really like was config.sys and autoexec.bat. bringing back scary memories already. As far as the architecture goes, I quite liked the microchannel architecture of the actual machines, but I saw that it wasn't going to win. So it was kind of just IBM. I don't know if they tried to license it, but if they did, they didn't do a very good job of it. And in the end, they just drowned under the ISA card slot standard.
Just out of curiosity, did you use the IBM 3270 cards or an aftermarket like an Irma or something like that?
We used the Irmas and the IBM ones. It just really depended on who was in the provisioning, I suppose, at the time. Which did make it a bit of a pain. So later on, later versions of the PS2, the 386 versions, and when we started using Windows 3.1 and 1.1, and we started using AttachMate Extra for all our mainframe connectivity terminal sessions, it became less of a hassle as to what card was actually inside. But we shan't turn this into how to talk to your mainframe.
It's a bit esoteric, I admit.
So another thing that was in the list is the Acorn Archimedes. Is that the place where the ARM chip started, or was it before that?
That's it. It's a big deal.
Yeah. So they're still running our running our machines. So that's cool. The Canon Cat, I'm pretty sure that the Cat has gotten a fair amount of discussion on the podcast generally, just because David Grealish had, I think he had a couple of them over the years. It's a really pretty interesting machine, which I've seen pictures of, but I don't anticipate ever having one. It's basically the result of the project that turned into the Macintosh eventually, but going the other way. So this was what's the guy's name now?
Jeff Raskin.
That's his name. Yes, it's his project. You can run it under emulation on, I think JSMS has it actually, which I'll talk about later too. But I managed to type a couple of words and attempt to leap around, not very successfully, but it's a neat thing that really got no play at all.
So. And the Amiga 500. That's an interesting machine, too, because when compared to the 8-bit computers of the time, the Amigas were fairly pricey, but the 500 was a low-end Commodore Amiga. So trying to bring the Amiga architecture closer to where people could, where everybody could use it as a home computer. And right. I noticed that a lot of the gaming was developed for that Amiga 500. Or that architecture, just due to the fact that that was the approachable low-end model.
Yeah, I think that was that's far and away the most popular machine, the most popular Amiga that they ever had. I think actually when these two devices came out, they actually discontinued the Amiga 1000. I think the 1000, it had a detached keyboard, but was in other ways, it was very similar to the 500. One thing I remember is I had one friend in college who had an Amiga 1000. And on that machine, it wasn't enough to actually insert a floppy with the OS. You first inserted a floppy with this thing called the Kickstarter or the Kickstart. Uh-huh. So you had kind of a double boot sequence. You first loaded the Kickstarter off of one floppy and then switched to the OS on another floppy. And when they came out to 500, they at least abandoned that. So you could just boot the OS off of a single floppy. Or if you had a game that was not reliant on the OS, you would just boot the game up directly off of the floppy.
I'm pretty sure I've seen I've seen on eBay these ROMs that you can get that I guess basically allow you to jump past the floppy Kickstarter stage. Is that what that is?
Right. Oh, that could be. Yeah, that could be a later adjustment. I'm not really sure.
Well, it had a long run. It lasted for 4 years, it says here on Wikipedia.
The 500 or?
The 500, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I bought one of these in 1990 or 91, I think. Maybe 89, I don't remember. That must have been 90. And it's interesting when you look back that you can see that, okay, here I am buying a computer that is exactly the same as it was when it came out 3 years ago. It's just something that doesn't happen anymore, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Nobody sells computers that are exactly the same for any length of time. Everything's different from year to year. But yes, they had an architecture that was, at the time it came out, especially in 87, it was well advanced of most of the other low-end computers out there. And even like in terms of graphics, it was, I dare say, better than even the beautiful IBM PS2 with its VGA. Probably.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the Amigas really took the prize there.
Yeah, so I spent a lot of my time in college using an Amiga 500 for all sorts of stuff, for games. And also I did a lot of my computer science work on that, wrote papers on it, all kinds of things. It was a really versatile, powerful machine that unfortunately was being sold by Commodore, who didn't know how to market things very well somehow at that point in time. So.
I've lamented before that I wanted to look at buying an Amiga, and I didn't even know where to go buy one. I didn't even know what store. This was obviously, decades pre-internet, and didn't know how I could actually buy one, how much they cost, any of that. It was kind of disgusting. Actually,
yeah, they were pretty much sold in like sort of specialty little computer shops for the most part, in my experience. Like there were no large retailers that carried them in any way, as far as I could ever see. You kind of had to know what you were doing and know what you were looking for to even get one.
The weird thing is that I even at the time, I'm pretty sure that I was kind of aware that they were really good machines. I was sort of aware that they had a very small market and they were really good machines. But I think somehow that wasn't enough to push me over the edge to actually get one, because I didn't want to be alone using this great computer.
Well, the software ecosystem is a big part of being successful with your computer. Speaking of which, the Apple Mac 2s, did you guys play with those much?
No.
A little bit.
I saw
This was pretty much after I'd left the Apple dealer that I had been working with. But I was impressed. The fact that we finally had a Mac that had, did it have 6 new bus slots compared to the previous Toaster Macs, which had none. So, and then I thought it was interesting that the SE that came out in the same year came out with 1 internal slot, but not the same slot architecture as the Macintosh 2. So
that really was kind of weird. But the Mac 2s were gorgeous machines, and this is where we really started bringing them in big time into aerospace. There was a concern about the portable Macs that they weren't expandable. And now all of a sudden you had a desktop computer that you could add some things to and maybe had a little bit of future proofing built in.
Yeah, I don't think I'm not sure that I ever actually used a 2 or you know, the like the 2FX and those things, but the ones that were a little bit later in that line, like the 2CI and 2CX, were all over the place. I mean, I'm not sure actually when those were released. It was probably not actually for another couple of years down the podcast road here, but the Macintosh 2 was huge, though. That's what I do remember. It's just a very large machine.
Yeah, I remember when in college, a couple years after this, there were a couple of them. I don't remember students having any, but I remember there was I had a job as a student network technician. So I was in all kinds of places, and there was, I think it was like a psychology lab that had a couple of these. And like you said, Paul, they were just enormous. They had pretty nice big screens hooked up to them too, which was nice, but it was the only other Macs I'd seen at that point were sort of the standard old, you know, traditional Mac size at that point, which was the little sort of can. I was like, wow, this is a huge thing, but they were really nice. And they did have, it was interesting to see that you, having been used to seeing the Mac interface on that small screen, suddenly see it on a relatively big screen and in color was pretty wild, actually.
And those Radius monitors, those were amazing. The you know, Radius made a set of monitors. Like there was one, I believe it was called the Radius Pivot,
yeah,
that you could connect up to the SE and you could actually switch it physically between landscape and portrait. And if I recall correctly, correct me on this if I'm wrong, but it would switch the screen display orientation based on which way you moved the monitor.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it could sense when you turned it. I'm not sure that, I think I may have only seen pictures of this though, so.
I think I remember seeing that at a computer exhibition. I never actually got to spin the monitor myself, but it was impressive. It was a very handy thing to get that orientation changed. I must admit I've only just started doing that with my large LCD monitors here within the last few years, so I'm glad to see I'm finally catching up.
Now, looking at the show notes, I realize that we've actually sort of split this into computers, devices, and software. And so devices actually would probably fit into this discussion that we've been having. But so I don't actually know how to pronounce the very first one. So, Jack, what is the first one?
Well, that's the Atari XEGS.
Okay, it's not like the Zegs.
No, it's the XE game system. So it was kind of really the, you could call it Zegs, I guess. I've never heard anyone call it Zegs, but hey, why not? So the Zegs was really the end of Atari's 8-bit line. It was basically, they had had the 130XE and the 65XE that came out a couple of years before, and they kind of repackaged the 65XE in a new case to make it look like it's just for playing games, sort of. But it still had a keyboard. The keyboard was detached, which was actually the only Atari 8-bit with a detached keyboard. And it had kind of the same stuff. So it had the same cartridge slot, the same serial I/O port. So anything you wanted to do with an Atari 8-bit computer, you could do with this. I think, though, that, you know, like Commodore, Atari at this stage in time could not market anything, and it was a complete flop. I've actually never even seen one of these in person. I've just seen pictures online, but they're still around, and they actually shipped this thing. I think it came with a light gun because they were trying to compete with Nintendo. Actually, so they had a couple of different light gun games, that sort of thing.
I've wondered about. So this was not successful enough for there to be a lot of them out then, because I was thinking that, you know, it, being the last one and still compatible with the Atari 8-bit, I wonder if this might be like the most reliable one to try to use this many years later. But not if I can't get one.
It could be, but you can get them. They're available. They're on eBay and stuff. So this is actually probably not a bad starting point if you want to do that kind of thing. Although I guess that the only difference being if you want to do any kind of the modern 8-bit hackery that people have been doing with like weird like being able to drive an HDMI port and that kind of thing, that's all pretty much you have to use one of the computers probably because those are more specific towards a specific chip and a specific piece of casing and stuff. So, But if you just want to try out an 8-bit and play some games and stuff, this is not a bad choice actually, because it's, well, again, it has a detached keyboard, which is sort of nice. It's a little bit more flexible.
Yeah. Although the Atari 800 particularly is a very nice looking machine, but, okay, so also on this list, the I don't have anything particularly to say about these myself, but Sega Master System was released in Japan, and Sun introduces Spark, the RISC CPU at the same year as the Sun 4 machine. So certainly I've heard the word Spark in Spark Station, but I don't really know very much about Sun generally.
Yeah, so that was their own RISC architecture that they had, and they used this in all of their, I don't want to say all, but in most of their machines up until they, you know, kind of stopped following that path at all. So like, I remember in college, we had a few Spark stations, and then later when I started working in, you know, various things, there were Spark stations and server hardware all based around Spark and that sort of thing. And it seemed to be pretty good, but it's, you know, again, it's one of these things that it, you know, as so often turns out to be the case, building your own proprietary CPU for just your own hardware to run just your own software doesn't always win in the long run, or if ever.
Yeah, I didn't have much exposure to the Sparks. It wasn't until, I suppose, for me, into the early 90s when I was using some SunSpark Spark station workstations connected to some of our high-end laser printers. They were running, effectively, they were doing the RIP for the PostScript and the AFP. Talking to the Xerox laser printers. So, they were solid. They were fast machines. Spec-wise, you know, they were really streets ahead of our PS2 and other workstations that we still had in our offices. I think once I moved out of the mid-90s, I've never touched one of those again. So,
they certainly provided a lot of the infrastructure for the dot-com era. The Sun Spark architecture was the huge metal behind, I would actually like to know what percentage it was of the websites during the dot-com boom that were running the Sun stuff. We even got, in the dot-com company I was working with, as far as buying what's called an Enterprise 10K Spark system, which is this ginormous, basically you could call it a mini computer if you want to try and size it. But very cool computers, and still to this day, I don't know whether to call the OS Solaris or Solaris. I'm sure people will write in and let me know.
They will say it is absolutely X, and X is going to be different for each email.
Right, I'll get 50-50 is what will happen. But I'm looking at an Ultra 30 that I got here as part of a group of old mid to late 90s Unix machines that I bought from a guy in town, and it still runs beautifully. So, nice stuff.
Yep.
The software list for 1987 is actually quite long, so I'll just mention a couple of things and then that are on the list that I have in front of me, but if anyone wants to jump in with any other things as well. Microsoft and IBM release OS 2 1.0. MS-DOS 3.3 was released, and that, I believe, lasted for quite a while. John McAfee creates Virus Scan, and beginning the McAfee company a little later. Windows 2, Perl. Larry Wall releases the first version of Perl.
Yay!
This is 1987 is a big year.
It is. Everything pales into insignificance compared to Perl.
Yeah, suddenly you can do everything in 1,500 different ways. HyperCard, that made a big splash for a while. Claris got spun off from Apple to handle their productivity suites. Leisure Suit Larry got in the list somehow. LucasArts releases Maniac Mansion. I never this is not something I ever played, but and then something Xanth software. See, there's the Z with the X releases Mighty Maze for the Atari ST.
Now, I'm afraid I'm the guilty party for putting in all the game stuff at the end there.
It's okay. My news for later is game related as well. So.
So the thing about Maniac Mansion, that's actually not a game that I ever played either. But the interesting thing was that Maniac Mansion was powered by this thing they had called SCUMM, which stood for something. It's S-C-U-M-M. It's some sort of acronym. And that's actually what powered all of LucasArts' later adventure games, or most of them. So like they made a lot of like Indiana Jones games, and I think the Temple of Monkey Island. There were a lot of like games that came out in the early 90s that were built around this, these sort of point-and-click adventures. And this was kind of their premier
well,
game
actually,
this.
Looking up in the wiki, the all-knowing Wikipedia, says that it's a script creation utility for Maniac Mansion.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I guess it would explain why it started in Maniac Mansion.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, I definitely heard Scum VM referred to, which seems to be like the current, I mean, I don't know how current, but somewhat current system under which you can run these games, I guess, in something like emulation.
Yep, that's something that is out there. Yeah. I remember trying that years ago on something, and it works.
That's the scumvm.org.
Mm-hmm.
Was Day of the Tentacle one of the games that were...
Yes, definitely was.
I'd like to play that and actually win it, because I was never able to win it back in the day. So this OS2 thing, that didn't make it, right?
No, this one version 1 didn't quite make it. I was a big OS2 user, but not until the early to mid-90s. So I'm still actually trying to track down original media for OS2 version 1 so I can at least have it on my software shelf. But, there was later versions of OS2 which had the Windows 3 compatibility in their virtual DOS environment. But, version 1 was more text-based. I was, next bullet point we got there is MS-DOS 3.3. I was a big user of DOS 3.3. And I believe that a lot of DOS 4.0 users used to go back to being DOS 3.3 users as well, because I don't know if it's deservedly or not, but MS-DOS version 4 did kind of get panned. I think it introduced the never-use-an-even version of DOS mythology came out from there.
Well, if you want a DOS version that didn't suck, then the ones you wanted were 3.3 or 6.22.
Oh, I love 6.22.
Yeah, pretty much anything else is just very creaky and, didn't do good things.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was I don't have any real associations with anything between, 3.3 and 6. You know, I there must have been an MS-DOS-4, but it I never crossed paths with it. One of the things that is that this is the era where it became confusing between Apple and IBM, because Apple DOS 3.3 lasted forever. There wasn't another one really until everything switched to ProDOS. But so saying this was a DOS 3.3 disk, at least at this point, was a confusing thing.
Confused the heck out of me because I never really changed over to ProDOS. So
I mean, you can't find anything if you put it in a subdirectory. Just keep everything right there in the one level. Any other things that anyone wanted to say? Talk about HyperCard and Myst?
Yeah, well, there was, as I said, Windows 2. So this is the first Windows that I started seriously using. But it was more just for the scanner workstation. It wasn't until Windows 3.1 came along that we started moving off DOS-only workstations. And John McAfee creates Virus Scan. I don't know. I'm still don't know if the virus scanning industry spawned the virus writers or the virus writers spawned the scanners. I've always been suspicious of this chicken and egg. But is that just me being paranoid?
Yeah, well, because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
Exactly.
No, that's right.
It definitely had crossed my mind to wonder once things really started exploding, in the virus world. But I do still sort of remember the relative safety that the Mac users had at that point, and until there were I think one of these control panel definition viruses or something that actually did start getting loose in the computer lab I was working in?
On the software side, we got down here. So Berkeley Systems was created, and I only know them for the After Dark screensaver. That's the only thing. If anyone says Berkeley Systems, that's all I think of is After Dark.
Flying toasters.
Yeah, flying toasters. Did they actually do anything else other than create flying toasters?
All I know is I just remember that, again, back in college, everyone that I knew had a Mac, plus every Mac that was in any sort of public lab or space anywhere had this thing installed, and 8 times out of 10 had flying toasters running. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just like, that was like the default look of all Macs that I ever saw was, oh, flying toasters.
Well, they apparently did have a best-selling product, the trivia game You Don't Know Jack. So, Jack, you should have known this.
I should have known.
Well, now we do, but yeah.
Yeah, and I remember actually, you know, seeing this product out there in the world, but I never tried it or anything. It didn't seem like somehow something I wanted to spend time doing. But yeah, the flying toasters. I mean, I assume that was basically just their own invention, right? And it had a huge cultural impact for a long time. Actually, I think if I'm not mistaken, it made its way into 90210 at one point. Wasn't that the nightclub had the flying toaster logo and was called After Dark?
Flying toasters and the dancing baby animation.
Oh, yeah, right.
I see here also Fairlawn releases PhoneNet. I don't know if you guys played with that, but in the Enterprise, that was huge because it let us use the Twisted Pair line to do the Apple local talk networking back to something like an Ethernet router. Because the Macs had that version of networking built in, that Fairlawn phone net really was an enabler for us. Mm-hmm. It was a big deal.
And just from the practical standpoint, it's much simpler to replace a phone cable, if something gets shut in a door or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, I certainly have. I have a bunch of these all over, except I lose those little Terminators. At the end, you connect them one to another, but you're supposed to put some sort of resistor in the other.
You just get an RJ11 and the right resistor, and it is pretty easy to actually make one of those Terminators.
Okay. Anything else that we should have said about 1987? Anyone?
I think the listeners will let us know.
I think they will. And in fact, Christopher wrote in, turning to listener feedback, bringing us all the way back to 1984 to remind us that we didn't mention the release of the Commodore SX64.
I am just falling down on the job as the Commodore guy here. But the SX64, the first color portable, and a beautiful machine, not real popular, and I'm not sure why, perhaps the price. But, or again, the marketing thing that Commodore suffered from. They're very popular now, though. Ironically, they're not unobtainium like some of the more esoteric models, but they will, if they're functional and if the keyboard latches work, they'll fetch a pretty hefty price on eBay.
It does really seem like, to however popular they were before, I've never heard anyone say anything bad about it except the keyboard doesn't work, you know, or stay closed. But I have one, and it starts, but the keyboard doesn't actually type. So I think, you know, there's something in the cable is not working, but I haven't actually troubleshot it. But it's really the idea that I could bring that over to, you know, Starbucks or whatever is very pleasing.
And as they showed on that T-Pug video, you can actually bring them
right
to Starbucks.
Let's see. So other listener feedback. Rich mentioned there's another podcast out there. I think it may be video also. The Amp Hour interviewed Bill Hurd, and so we'll have a link to that. And Earl also has. So Earl can tell us what to probably expect. I don't think any of us actually have listened to this interview yet.
I can tell you that Bill Hurd is a great storyteller, a great speaker, and is very enthusiastic to convey some of the history of Commodore. And I did have a chance to talk to him on RetroBits, and he was a wonderful guest. So although I haven't heard this episode yet of Amp Hour, I can just pre-recommend it.
Right.
It's going to be fun.
Excellent. If we missed your feedback, listener, sorry, we'll try to get to it next time, but thank you for sending feedback. The last one that I was going to mention is that Tony wrote to point out Brian's video look at Muse software, which actually is, I think the video has been up for maybe a year old or something by now. But it's a kind of an interesting take on a review of the work of a very early Apple II company. So they started very early and released a bunch of cassette tapes in the first few years and moved up to disk software. They're probably most famous for Castle Wolfenstein. And they did branch out beyond the Apple II a little bit later on. But so it's kind of a neat, not very long little video, 10 minutes or something like that, where you can actually see the cassettes and demonstrating some of the software. And I'm not exactly sure why, except for that it's a very early company, but there's something that I find very intrinsically interesting about Muse. Okay, let's see. So I guess we're at the point, probably beyond the point, where we should be talking about items of interest and news. So, Earl, you have the first one.
Well, back in the early days of programming for Windows, if you looked at the C code that you had to use to create programs, you'd swear that the characters weren't even Roman characters, that you were looking at hieroglyphics, because the programming was so obtuse and weird. So Windows itself sought to be user-friendly, but programming it was really a walk through the forest at night. So Visual Basic was probably the first thing to change that. When people hear Visual Basic, you either love it or you hate it. Some people think it was fantastic, continues to be fantastic to this day in its .NET iteration, and other people think it's the scourge of the earth. But whatever you feel, if you're interested in how it got started and what products and source code and that were morphed into Visual Basic, there's a great article over on forestmoon.com that we'll link to from one of the original architects that talks about the birth of Visual Basic. And I found it fascinating. You know, I've worked for software companies a couple different times in my career and have noticed that there is a desire to reuse source code. Sometimes it would have been better, even if you didn't reuse your source code, if you just wrote something from scratch. And it sounds like that might have been the case here. But they took one product or a couple different products and they morphed it into Visual Basic, and the rest was history, because once mere mortals could get their hand on creating Windows programs, it actually was a very powerful paradigm. So anyway, we'll link over to this. I think folks will enjoy reading about it.
Yeah, I think they should. I actually found my original installation floppies for VB3 when I was moving my stuff into the 8-bit bunker. But I haven't actually done any VB programming. Well, not since VB3. I didn't actually move past that, but it was an excellent tool for, as you said, for prototyping as well as developing. You were able to quickly throw together something and get your ideas, and then basically I would then hand that over to an actual Windows development team to get that utility going. But it was, from my perspective, a great way of getting a working proof of concept going.
That's a really great idea, using VB as a rapid development tool and then turning that over so that they could turn it into a more performant, probably better architected program, but still very, very cool.
Yeah, I've never used Visual Basic myself, but I did I toyed around a little bit with a competitor, what is it called, Real Basic, which I think it has the same sort of underlying basic language, but you're doing object oriented things like, you know, adding code to buttons and things like that. It's interesting. I don't know. It doesn't feel like basic though.
No, the no, syntax no, looks yeah. a little like basic, but
yeah. Yeah. It was sort of the it wasn't basic. It's not basic as we know it. Mm-hmm. Might be the best way of describing it, but I thought it was a great prototyping tool, and then I'd let the API and C programmers take over from there.
So, let's see. And Michael, actually, you have the next one.
Yes, EdSAC. So, in the week past, they've announced over at the National Museum of Computing that the EdSAC project has got 70 of their chassis are now in place, and that's half of the total of what they're doing. So this is one of the Cambridge computers back from 47, I think. So their aim is to rebuild as close to the original machine as possible, and then they have a caveat there allowing for modern day safety and workplace standards, because those older big metal computers had lots of sharp and pointy bits, as well as exposed voltage. Wouldn't get past these days, but back then that wasn't so much an issue. So as I say, workshops, sheds, and even kitchen tables across the country have been called to action to build and test each of the chassis. So if you're into press sheet metal and valves and exposed wiring and call it computing, this is a project that you should be following. It's very interesting to see a computer that used to exist and then virtually all of them scrapped, and now they're just trying to find all of the construction and wiring and circuit information that's available and build it while they still have people who can actually remember it. So a good little kitchen project, it would seem, if you don't mind having a kitchen totally taken over by a computer chassis.
So is this something that you say existed in the late 40s?
Yes.
Okay. I've never heard of this at all. I remember hearing things like the ENIAC and some other ancient things. This one is totally off my radar somehow.
Let's see. The goal is to build an authentic working replica of the EDSAC computer and to run a program on it as it was done when the original machine was demonstrated in May 49. So, yeah.
But, hopefully all the sharp edges didn't wind up, you know, just meaning that there were no survivors.
I like how that their next milestone, which will be later this month, is when all their when the input and output will be demonstrated with the help of a Raspberry Pi. I think the Raspberry Pi still might have considerably more computer grunt than EDSAC ever did.
That's very embarrassing.
Okay, well, that's me. That's me for big metal. So literally.
The next thing on the list is I believe that this actually was announced between the last show and this show, and it's kind of made the rounds everywhere. But Jason Scott and the JS Mess group have kind of made a public internet arcade, you know, that has basically in-browser emulation of a whole bunch of, you know, stand-up arcade games run basically through the MAME emulator. And so, you know, it got announced. It actually made the news. In fact, he was on something, some, you know, it was announced, and there was a big spike in people trying it out. But it's a neat thing to look at if you haven't looked at it, and if somehow you're listening to this real time and didn't follow all the links that got tweeted at you. But you know, I tried it out. I tried a couple of these out. I really don't like Super Pac-Man, but at any rate, it's you know, it's workable. Whatever. It's a neat, you know, sort of step forward in at least sort of demonstrating the capacity of in-browser emulation like this. I did, in fact, actually, if you, I think I just messed with the URL at the top, but I managed to start the Apple III emulator just to the point where I could see it doing the RAM check, you know, so I think we're getting closer and closer to being able to do, you know, a lot of things in the browser. So I'm still very impressed by the JS Mess project.
I learned how to play Joust.
Oh, yeah, oh. That's hard.
Yeah, Joust is one of those games that you got to kind of get the feel for it, and I guess I wasn't willing to spend the quarters back in the day to try and figure it out, because you die pretty fast if you don't get it. And so thanks to the Internet Arcade, because now I know how to play Joust. Now if I could just beam myself back in time, I could go to some of those stand-up consoles and play it. But
right.
Yeah, I think about all the quarters I spent on all of those games as a kid, as a teenager. It never occurred to me that someday I can just play all of these things on any old computer that I have at home for free. It's pretty amazing.
Mm.
I would have saved a fortune on GORF.
Oh, GORF. Oh, my nemesis. That did swallow a lot of quarters, GORF.
Yeah. So, let's see. So, Jack, I will turn to you. You have an acronym to talk about?
Yeah, I have a bit of news here. So, I know you guys are familiar with KFest, obviously. There seems to be something that is along those lines around Atari 8-bit computers in Germany. So there's a club called the Atari Bitbiters User Club, ABUC for short. I only know about this thanks to the guys over at the Antic podcast. And they have an annual competition where people submit they have actually two competitions, one for software, one for hardware. That is the idea that people will submit new projects, things that they have built for the Atari 8-bit computers. And they just had they announced the winners of their contest 2 weeks ago. And I think along with this, they have some sort of event, I believe. The website's in German, and I don't really speak German, so I'm not really quite sure. But you can find some interesting things, and there are both interesting projects like plenty of new games being written. There was an interesting hardware project that was actually both for the Atari 8-bit and for the Commodore 64. This thing called MIDI Fun, I believe. And MIDI Fun lets you plug it into the joystick port of one of these machines, and you run some software on the 8-bit computer, and it lets you plug in a MIDI cable into this hardware device. So you can, from a modern computer, from any sequencer software you have, you can control either the Pokey chip on an Atari 8-bit or the SID chip on a Commodore 64 and actually just play that as an instrument. It's pretty cool. So anyway, if anyone is interested in looking into what's going on in the Atari 8-bit world, this seems to be one thing. And it's interesting because it seems like these 8-bit machines had a longer life in parts of Europe than they ever did in the U.S. Like, I know there are a lot of Polish users of Atari 8-bit computers, and of course their websites are even more impenetrable, so it's hard to know what's going on at all, as far as I'm concerned. But there's been interesting hardware hacks and stuff there. We may talk about it some other time. But anyway, AdBook is an interesting thing to look at. You can get some links and some pointers to some interesting games to play on your Atari 8-bit or emulator.
Yeah, interesting. I still feel like I don't entirely know what the computing environment was like outside of North America, but it is interesting that it seems like Atari made more inroads there, or maybe just later. It's possible that it's just the second wave or something. But
yeah, I think it's just later. I think one story that I've heard is that Jack Tremel, having come from Eastern Europe himself, in sort of his later days at Atari, he hit upon the idea to market these machines towards that market. So there are apparently special versions of, like, the Atari 65XE that are targeted at Eastern European market, and they have a slightly different character set. And I think one was sold as the 800XE or something, just like a different marketing name to kind of tie in with the old names. And probably these were still being sold up until the early 90s. And they, by that time, of course, they were dirt cheap, so they were, you know, possible for people to buy, even if they were coming out of a, you know, recently communist economy and didn't have a lot of cash to spend. It's interesting. I haven't really delved into the people and communities that are still doing stuff with this in Poland too much, but they're out there.
And the MIDI, you know, using your Commodore 64 or Atari computer as an instrument is a very cool idea. It actually does make them sort of useful in a way that they, you know, you need the actual machine to do this.
Yeah, because, I mean, of course, there are emulators that emulate these sounds, but in my opinion, to my ear, it doesn't actually sound the same as I remember that they used to sound these things. So it seems like the actual hardware is different from emulation on modern hardware, in my opinion. So I actually might have to check out that device myself, because it seems like that's a pretty fun use of my one 8-bit Atari that's lying on a shelf somewhere.
And just a quick note before we move on, the website that Jack linked off to here, the Atari Age .com forums, that really, I think we've mentioned it before, but that seems to be the go-to place for Atari 8-bit stuff, and I think a lot of Atari gaming stuff as well.
That's right. Atari 8 is really kind of the place for all of the discussions of all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's the watering hole for the Atari folks.
Yeah, very much so. A fun site where you can find all kinds of everything from people talking about new projects they're working on to just talking about old games. And there's some sort of there's an Atari Age high score club of some kind where they pick a game and say, all right, we're going to try out this game. You know, what kind of high score can you get on this particular game? And everyone gives it a try. And there seems to be an interesting sort of community there that I just don't really have quite enough time to spend reading forums, but there it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely see it linked to all the time, and with the current influx of, you know, Atari podcasts, I hear about it all the time as well.
Yeah.
Okay, Michael, turning our attention to Commodore. Yes. What do you have?
Well, it's a Kickstarter project that I and 731 other backers are going for. Had an original goal of £25,000, but they've just gone over 40,000, so this one's a goer as well. But yeah, it's Matt Gray's soundtracks from the Commodore 64 games being remastered and released either on hard media or digital downloads. So if you're after some C64 game music to play, listen to, otherwise enjoy, this might be a Kickstarter project for you.
Hmm. So I don't entirely understand this. So is it it's not being produced? It was originally written on a C64 and is now being produced on modern hardware.
No, it's for game soundtrack remakes.
Right. But are SID chips involved in the new thing?
I'm not quite sure exactly what they're using to do the remastering, but I believe that there will be SIDs in there.
Okay, interesting.
I see one screenshot that says each track will be remade to the highest quality, keeping the distinctive SID sound intact.
Nice.
So it could be that they're doing something as simple as instead of letting the SID chip play all three audio tracks at once, that they're having to go one at a time, record them separately to be able to mix them more nicely than the SID chip might mix them itself. Maybe?
Well, and sometimes they throw in modern instruments too. If you want a sample of what some of this sounds like, one of the Commodore podcasts out there, the C64 Takeaway, it's kind of semi-regularly published by Jan-Lund Thompson. And, you know, some of the songs that you'll hear will be just pure SID, but others will be modern-day takes on what the original songs were, but with modern instruments, still sometimes sounding like a chiptune with that style, but more modernized. It's like a remix. So yeah. Fun to tune into, and there's some really catchy music in there.
Yeah, I listen to that one occasionally for my drive. There's some days where you just want to go back to that kind of electronica as far as music goes.
There are actually groups. I mean, professional groups.
Yeah, 8-bit weapon to come to mind, but there are others.
Exactly.
As well.
I think Press Play on Tape is another one, if I remember right.
Okay, let's see. So time's ticking by here. Maybe I'll make a quick mention also of there's an interesting thing that got posted on Mike Willigal's blog, which was talking about an exchange that he had with Steve Wozniak, where at the end of the email that he Mike got back, Woz had said something about that he, you know, just actually recently, I don't know how long ago, like a couple weeks ago or something, he had kind of in a dream realized like a way that he could have saved a couple of chips on the Apple II and made two grays that are otherwise indistinct different. So it's kind of neat to just see this note, you know, that first of all that, you know, Woz is still thinking about it, and that we got to sort of share in this little email exchange. So there's a link to the blog posting, but it's short, but it's kind of neat to read.
Introducing the new Atari XE video game system, the only game system that teaches you to fly. It comes with Flight Simulator 2 and a keyboard to play many advanced computer games. But that's not all. You can pilot your Atari through hundreds of other exciting games because it also comes with a target gun and the great game Bug Hunt. And it plays the most challenging joystick games like Missile Command. The new Atari XE video game system, the only one that has it all.
Okay, so I think we're, I'm a host and I'm not directing this traffic very well, so let me get back on the time track here, and we'll start talking about the retro computing gift idea. It is cufflinks, and they come in a couple of different types. This particular set of cufflinks that is on my screen is a little blue apple. So if you wanted a little blue apple cufflink, you can get this. And somewhere in the history, and which will be in the show notes, are similar-ish cufflinks that have the Commodore logo in them.
May I add that the blue apple logo, it looks like kind of like the shiny sort of Aqua interface from the early days of Mac OS X, these sort of lickable buttons.
Right.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah, more back to your Jaguar days.
Right, exactly. So we're getting toward the holiday season, and so gifts must be exchanged. These are affordable, or you can give people, you know, an MSI, but the cufflinks will probably break fewer banks.
These are nice. I'm a Commodore guy, but if I was going formal, I would wear these Mac cufflinks rather than those Commodore ones.
Yeah. I can imagine better Commodore ones than this that particular instantiation of the ones we were looking at. But
like a more subtle chicken head.
Yeah,
kind
exactly.
Of shape. Yeah.
But okay. And continuing on the buying spree as we lead into the holiday season, we have eBay auctions. So Earl, you can start. What is yours?
Well, I have what is self-titled a massive Atari 800 XL collection. And they're not kidding. You've got the 800 XL, a disk drive, a modem. These things, a lot of these things have the original boxes. And there's software, and there are some books, some really nice titles, actually. Some of the titles from Compute and such for the Atari. And all of this has a starting bid of $50 US. You can buy it now if you want for $100 US, which I actually think is a decent price for this collection. You even get a couple joysticks. And here's another beauty part of this. The person has tested this equipment and says that it works. And you guys know that's one of my fixations on these vintage computers. I like when they've been tested and you know you're not buying junk. So I was really impressed by this auction.
Yep, I agree. That looks like a very good sort of starter kit for anyone who wants to grab some Atari stuff and get up and running.
Yeah, I'm so much forcing my hand away from the buy it now button.
That is really quite a reasonable buy it now, given all that stuff that's in there. I mean, with the boxes and everything.
And shipping isn't even terrible. It's coming from Grand Rapids, Michigan. To me, the shipping would be $37. Mm. So for all that stuff, that doesn't strike me as bad at all.
Yep, and yeah, that's U.S. shipping only, but yeah, that's probably about another $50, $75 to get it down here to Sydney. But yeah.
This is tempting. Yeah,
I'm just taking my hand away from the keyboard, from the trackpad.
Yeah, given that the last one you snaked away from us hasn't arrived yet, right?
No, I'm thinking of the somewhat limited lifespan I'd have trying to sneak this one into the house at the moment.
Right, exactly. Okay, and so, Michael, actually, yours is next on the list. What is this?
Yes, something smaller and easier to sneak into the household. This is the Corsen System Soft Strip System Scanner Reader for the Apple series computers. So back in the 80s, Nibble magazine and some other magazines started putting, they were mostly advertisements, but Corsen would put a program listing in their advertisement. And what was unique about that is that it used a 2D barcode to actually store the program data and listing. It never really caught on that much, but it was an interesting way of publishing programs and then reading them into your computer. But to me, it kind of removed the enjoyment of actually typing it in yourself. It's something I've just been sort of keeping an eye on myself. And this one here looks to be quite a good price. Buy it now, but I think I might leave this one for the audience.
So was the idea that you would tear the page out of the magazine and feed it through this somehow?
No, it was a scanner that you would actually just put over the top of the print. So you didn't need to remove it from the page physically. It had registration marks on there that you basically lined up the black dot and the tail of the program and then just ran the scanner over it. And then you would just, if it was a multiple strip program, you would then just move on to the next strip and read it in. There, I believe, was also a IBM PC kit that came with it that allowed you to use it on DOS machines as well. Later on, so it's an interesting technology which didn't really go too far.
This is awesome. You know what would really be cool is if
reverse engineering the soft strip from a TIFF put into a Perl program.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, retro, if you could figure out a
retro
way
challenge
to create
material.
Yes. If you could create new software in printout form and then read it with this, that, what fun.
It does sort of seem like that, you know, I kind of wonder for the price of this thing, you know, how many discs, mailed discs it would be, because it kind of seems like it arrived on the scene a little late in a way. I mean, you just.
Yeah, there's some pictures of the actual scanner there, so it just shows how has the base and then the scanner section, so that you just put the page in between and get the registrations lined up and then just move it across the page.
I am pretty sure that I have seen this, seen some code written in this way before, but I can't quite remember. In the auction pictures, it mentions Nibble magazine, which is one of the big Apple magazines, and it's possible that it was in there somewhere that I saw these, you know, the things you could have read with this device.
Well, I suppose they advertised in Nibble because Nibble was physically a high-quality magazine, so the actual print of the advertisements with the programs in it, and then there were also a couple of article reviews with the programs in them. So you were pretty much as a company guaranteed of good quality print, but still, even then it was a bit on the pricey side to get hold of that scanner and use it. But you know, anyone could type in a basic listing or a machine code routine. Either with or without the checksum information that magazines would provide with their listings. An interesting view to alternate media in the past.
Yeah, well, and quite possibly it survived when lots of floppies didn't.
Mm.
I was thinking the same thing. It is probably more durable media, in fact.
Yeah, well, we wouldn't be suffering from disk rot or anything like that, but then there's a whole new creepy crawlies that want to nibble on your programs, I suppose.
So we need to etch our programs in stone.
That's right. Yeah, that's it. Chisel them on to slate and just have them erected in our backyard as a totem.
I think those Vikings were onto something.
Yes.
Even carved their text in kind of a strip. Going around a stone. Maybe had this in mind.
Excellent.
They were ahead of their time. They were distracted by their other core activities.
Okay, so I have fallen down a little bit on the job here on the eBay department. I have just the one. So the auction that I'm pointing to is a Next Station Turbo Color. And actually, one of the things that made me that drew me to this is the fact that the starting bid is 99 cents. It's definitely worth more than that. But the auction, actually, as I'm looking at it, isn't actually all that good of an auction. There's unless other people can see things I can't, there really is almost no description whatsoever. There are just pictures. It is in fantastic condition. So, and then the Turbo Color is, I think, the last of the Next machines before, basically, you know, they gave up on the hardware.
Yep.
So, I mean, I think if you want to have a Next experience, this is probably a good one to have. You can play, you know, the original Doom and run the original web browser and so forth. And it looks like it's in pretty good shape. The one thing that so it's basically just the unit. Although actually, there are some pictures of the screens working.
For something that's called Turbo Color, it's just a giant black slab, except for the four colors of the Next logo.
Yes, although it's the screen that's in color, but and I think this comes with a power cord too. But the trick with these things is you do need to get you need to get a compatible. I think I don't know if this one takes an ADB keyboard. It might.
I think these were ADB keyboards.
Yeah, there's an earlier generation of these that was a little bit more proprietary, but. So you do have to get some extra stuff to make this thing run. And actually, the monitor cable was I have one of these, and it took quite a long time to get a monitor working because it needs to sync on green and has to have this particular connector that took me a while to get. But yeah,
he's at least showing that it's working. So you got the screenshots, and he also mentions that there is a external Sony Magneto optical drive, which is. Probably on a separate auction listing.
Wow, did not. So you know, honestly, I think there really is some stuff I can't read here.
Yeah, click on his other items, Uh-huh. And we have a next laser, next sound box with Y cable, mouse, printer cable. There's the optical drive, the keyboard, whole pile of software, the turbo color itself, and the 21-inch color display. Oh, and a 2004 copy of Microsoft Office.
Microsoft Office, yeah, for, like, randomly, yeah.
That often happens. If you're just after the slab, that's a pretty good auction, but all the others there are similarly good prices, and it looks like try and pick up those, you'd have a good little turbo color system.
Yeah, I think if you had nothing to start with, you'd end up kind of having to get a lot of pieces, but if you managed to get most of these things and say, all I really need is that printer or whatever.
It seems to be bidding interest on the software and books, but at the moment, no one's bidding on the actual hardware units.
Yeah, I think, I'm not exactly sure where I come down on this question of parting things out like this, but I know that, have a lot of superfluous machines around here because I wanted one thing in an auction that had many, many things in it. I can sort of see, like, if I just needed the soundbox, I don't really want to get the whole everything, because then what I'm going to feel like I need to do is now get another soundbox because I don't want to have an incomplete system. The laser, so actually, I guess what my auction pick is, up for one. It's the whole guy's.
You have a de facto multi listing here.
So you did it.
Excellent.
You got multiple things. Good job, Paul.
I'm looking at the list, and the laser printer looks to me like it's doing the same thing. I have one of these that does exactly this. I think there's a latch
sit there and do nothing.
Well, that too. But I mean, I'm not sure. But the lid doesn't close, and I think there's a latch on these things that I think breaks pretty easily. I'm still actually trying to find a good solution for that might allow the thing to still be usable while. So I don't just have to like glue it shut and put it on a shelf. It's nice looking stuff, and I know, and you know, part of in the very back of my mind, I had this came to mind because I know that Jack and I both back in the early days worked on Next, and I think back on my Next programming days as that was basically the most fun I ever had programming. It was a fantastic experience.
Yeah, it was really good times, and for me that actually sort of became the start of my career in many ways, because I continued working on Next Step, OpenStep, Mac OS X. I kind of got stuck in Objective-C 20 years ago and kept going with it. And so after college, when we had some of the older Next hardware there, I got a job doing some Next Step and OpenStep based consulting, which sounds surprising just to even think that existed, but it did.
Right. And you were the only one doing it.
Yeah. And so we used both Intel hardware, because at that point already NextStep had been ported to run on Intel. And we had a few of these kind of turbo colors and that sort of thing around the office to work on. And they were really, really nice machines. And it was a very nice environment to work in.
Okay. And then I guess, Jack, you have the last of the auctions on our list.
Yeah. So I actually, I did step up to actually start off with two of them. One of them is very much in theme with what we were talking about earlier with the release of the Atari XE game system, or ZEGS, as we shall call it, in 1987. This listing is actually titled Vintage Atari XE. They seem to have forgotten the GZ part of ZEGS. It seems to be a nice package. It looks like it has a single joystick and has the light gun. Does not have any games as far as I can see, but it's listing right now for $39 as the buy it now price. It says shipping is $50, which seems kind of extreme. But comparatively, based on elsewhere, I've seen these sell for quite a bit more on eBay. So, and the nice thing about this, again, is it's not, even though it looks like it's a game system, it's kind of its own thing, you can use absolutely anything that works on the Atari 8-bits otherwise for this. You can plug in disk drives, you can play any cartridge games, whatever you want to do, it should all work. The other thing that I wanted to point out was the rare Atari brochure catalog from circa 1983 that lists the computers that they were launching that year, including the 1400XL and 1450XLD prototypes, which were vaporware and never came out, but were listed actually in this brochure. And someone for the brochure, $59.95. I wouldn't pay that kind of money. But
you can make an offer, though.
That's true. There is make an offer. That's true. I could offer a dollar.
It's very pretty. I mean, it looks like the brochure's in good condition. And like you say, it has that a picture of that 1450 XLD, which is probably the closest I'll ever come to owning one.
Yep.
Yeah, well, it's a 32-page catalog, so that's not quite $2 a page.
So the 1450 XLD looks like a thing, though. I mean, you know, vaporware or not, I mean, it's a pretty solid-looking thing.
They existed, right? They existed. Yeah,
they made some. They just never sold any.
Okay, so there were, like... It's not an artistic delusion, I mean, interpretation.
No. It actually was a physical thing, and they were visible at dealers and trade shows to some extent, but were never on sale. So...
Well, yeah, it's interesting looking. I was going to say, though, on the XEGS thing, I hate to say it, does not look very pretty.
No, that's true. It does not look pretty. Although I've seen worse. So you see, if you mouse over this, the keys are kind of looking dingy and yellow.
But I think just a little cleaning would probably take care of it.
Yeah, maybe. But I don't know. I have a 130XE, which is from, you know, roughly the same time period and the same color scheme as this. Mm-hmm. And those keys, I don't think I can get them any better than they are. It just seems like yellowing is, and in fact, if you're looking at forums on Atari Age or anywhere that people are talking about buying old systems, they're always talking about the relative amount of yellowing of the keys. It's just like a scourge of all old Atari computers, apparently.
Right.
But I saw one of these on eBay recently where not only were the keys sort of dingy yellow like this, they were almost like bright, violent yellow. It just makes you wonder what happened.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that somewhere along the line when I was looking at eBay, I saw it was probably an Apple II or something, but someone had just painted it yellow. You know, never mind. We're not going to let it get halfway yellow.
Why fight it? Yes.
Yeah.
back on the brochure, did anyone notice the tagline at the end of the description? It says no size, 32 pages, 31 years old. The tagline is, a great addition to your vintage Apple computer collection.
Ouch. Oops. Well, copy and paste. That's interesting. Who is this? Oh, I see who this is. Okay. All right. That would make sense. This person sells a lot of Lisa stuff and things.
He's boilerplated from one of his standard listings, and not quite. There's an extra rivet should have gone into that boilerplate to hide that one.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a seller that sells 130XEs brand new in the box, and they don't come with a serial number or anything because they apparently were in Atari's overstock that they could kind of emergency ship to different countries to fill stock requirements. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it makes me, and it's $195 US to get one of those. It makes me wonder, though, if you got one and took it out of the box, how long would it be before it yellowed? Is this something that happens over time? Or, I mean, would you take it out of the box and see it spontaneously yellow before your eyes, like forever young kind of thing?
Or? You mean like the 30-something years catching up with it in 30 seconds?
Exactly. Yeah, I don't. It's part of the plastic chemistry, but I don't know how age affects it versus sunlight. So.
Is it sunlight? Is it air? I'm not really sure.
It's funny. It really does seem like it. You know, we haven't quite figured out what it is because certainly, you know, often it's been mentioned that, you know, things that stay in the dark in the basement in a box still yellow.
Right.
But yet, certainly on things that I have, you can see clearly this was sitting in the sun with a cord on it, and that's why it has this weird looking, like, you know, strange suntan.
So. Yeah, my Apple IIc is a lovely shade of not white, and it basically wasn't sitting in the sun either, so I think the sunlight must accelerate it, but I think that just the being open and exposed, I don't know, it's painful. I still don't know if I'll be retro-briding mine. I just sort of take it that it's aged more gracefully than I.
I'm always worried that I'm going to make it worse. I mean, I have at least gotten all the components for doing retro-briding, and it's been sitting here looking at me for about a year and a half, probably. I just can't quite... I can't... There's nothing that I really quite am ready to sacrifice to this.
I think if I do get a... it'll be buying a second system and getting it, having it retro-brided or doing it myself just so that I've got it there as this is what it looked like new. But this one over here is the one that I bought back in 84, and these are all the bits and pieces I have with it. And I think I've got too much emotional involvement with my original Apple IIc to actually go and dip it into RetroBrite. And, I don't know. Yeah. I don't want to hurt the poor thing.
Well, my metallic Commodore PET isn't going to yellow, baby.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They're just sitting there. Okay. Well, so I think that we've gone a little over the hour anyway, and so this is probably a good time to close things out with closing discussions and any sort of news from life. So, Earl, do you have anything going on there?
No, kind of a boring 2 weeks. I think I'll just pass.
Okay. Michael?
Well, I survived my fundraising bike ride. So with all the riding to the station and to the event and whatnot, so I ended up doing about 110 kilometres for the 90-kilometre ride. But, the weekend I have been wrestling Canary Island date palms, and I wish to just make a statement. They are not ornamental. They are evil, and they must be destroyed. They've got nasty, sharp, pointy spines at the bottom of each of the palm fronds, so I had to fully suit up, leather gloves, safety glasses, loppers, saw, and cut the buggers out, and they have been appropriately dealt with. Not before they inflicted wounds on me.
Oh, no.
Many hit points.
Yeah.
Are they invasive? I mean, is it like, dandelions or whatever, where if you don't get rid of them, they'll take over?
Well, considering that the smallest one was my height.
So it's a slow takeover.
Yeah, they are, but there are some council areas that have them listed as a noxious weed. It's just the date seeds in them, the birds get them, fly elsewhere, nature takes its course, and a fertilizer-packed pellet sits in the garden or the bush or whatever, and they are painful plants, literally. But none on my acreage there will be. So I haven't seen any others. So these three are gone, and I can now concentrate on getting that garden section looking nice. But that was my non-computer activities. So. On the computer side of things, I picked up a Apple Display 15-inch monitor, the one that has the composite video input. So I'm going to be using that for some of my older retro machines that have the PAL or NTSC output.
That came up, I don't know, it must have been 9 episodes or something ago.
Yeah, it was something Carrington mentioned, and I put a watch in on eBay, and they were all popping up in the US, and they were all in the $50 to $70 mark, and then large amount of money to ship them to Sydney. But a couple of weeks ago, two popped up at a local film studio for $20 each pickup. So I went in and grabbed one.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I have one that doesn't have the composite in, is kind of annoying.
Yeah, well, that was the main reason I got it, that it had the composite as well as the just the standard stereo input as well. So it will hopefully do well for my older machines both a larger screen than the smaller 9 or 10 inch green screens or the smaller CRT TVs that I've got. Yeah, even my original green screen monitor for my 2C is starting to have a bit of a vertical hold issue that I'm going to have to investigate. But I have a slightly less old replacement monitor.
Yeah, I'm certainly worried about mine. You know, like for the moment, I just cross my fingers and hope that all my CRTs continue to work. But let's see. So what I've been doing? What have I been doing? I've spent actually a fair amount of time kind of cleaning computers that are laying around the office in an attempt to sort of like test them and so forth. Done a lot of disk imaging. I don't know, fairly random stuff for me. Nothing exciting to report quite yet. I don't know, Jack. What's up with you? Oh yes, you have an interesting thing to talk about actually.
Yeah, so I have a thing. So this past week I was at a conference here in Sweden called Ördev, which takes place in not in Stockholm but in Malmö, which is right near. Copenhagen. It's right across the water from Denmark, basically. And this is a conference on modern software development. But I managed to sneak in some retroactivity there. So I gave a talk about 6502 assembly programming for the Atari 2600. This is along the lines of what Paul mentioned before. I gave a talk months ago to my colleagues at ThoughtBot about this, and I give a more expanded version now where I actually went a little bit deeper into the assembly code. And it was a good time. I had a pretty full crowd, and people seemed to like it. People came afterwards and reminisced about some old days. There's one woman who dropped by and said that she grew up near Philadelphia and had a friend whose father worked at Commodore. And so he came in the early 80s and was telling the school class about his work and how he did 6502 assembly programming. And of course, all the 10-year-old and 11-year-olds did not understand it. But it was a fun time. And also at the same conference, there was another guy, a Swedish guy here, who was talking about a book he's recently published, which is called Generation 64. Which is unfortunately only in Swedish at this point, but it was essentially an interview book about he talked to various current industry leaders, people who are leading Swedish tech companies today, who all claim the Commodore 64 as one of their primary, if not the primary, thing that got them started in computing. And this is people who are running gaming studios today, like obviously Marcus Persson, who runs Mojang, and people running Spotify, all kinds of Swedish founders who have their clearly say that we got our start in the 8-bit era. So that was also a fun thing to see. And overall, it was good just to inject some and see some other people injecting some old-timey stuff into all of this modern talk about how to build software today.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering if the people who were in your audience, they weren't surprised by what you were talking about, right?
No, they weren't surprised. They could choose. It's a multi-track conference. There at any time there are seven or eight things you can go and see. So they made their choice.
Yeah, they chose to listen.
Awesome.
Yep. And the videos from this talk from this whole conference, all the videos go up online. The one that I'm mentioning that I did right now is not this minute online, but probably by the time the show is published, it will be. So we'll put it in the show notes.
Excellent. I will look forward to watching it. The short launch talk was definitely very, very worth watching. So very, very succinct, but still sort of communicated a lot. So it's just kind of fun to see this kind of early development systems talked about. And actually, the other thing is, there's a sense in which I kind of feel like I'm in this space all the time in my own head. Because I am doing this. Other people who hadn't thought about it for 25, 30 years or something, it would be neat to see their reaction to, oh yeah, I remember, having to switch the picture out as the beam was going or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting how much we take for granted that we can do easily today that required a lot of hard work back then. And then at the same time, the old systems were tailored to do certain things more or less automatically. So like on the Atari 2600, it didn't really have... There wasn't a lot you could do graphically with it, but the things that you could do were sort of always there and always on. It was just a matter of setting bit patterns for the sprites and setting locations, and you'd move them around. You didn't have to create sprites because they were already there. You just decided when to turn them on and off.
Okay, so I guess that's it. That's it. I did a very poor job of holding us to an hour, but that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all of the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com, and you can discuss the show in the forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, and you can send us feedback at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, and please write us a review on iTunes to help other people find the show. Thanks to Jack for joining us today, and until next time,
Retro Compute!